This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Why are we heading hell-bent into a world that nobody wants? Social philosopher Daniel Schmattenberger has the best explanation. He warns adding artificial intelligence to the unsustainable system we have right now will speed the decline towards disaster for humanity. Daniel talks with UK science communicator, television presenter, and former professional poker player, Olivia Livbury. Then we talk wildfires and climate change with Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan. This is a new interview. Mike Flanagan explains why burning the great boreal forests of the north could change the world climate for all of us. I'm Alex Smith. Moloch, whose love is endless oil and stone. Moloch, whose soul is electricity and banks. Moloch, whose poverty is the specter of genius. That is a quote from Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl, published in 1955.
Not available in Florida.
Moloch, the false god mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, is now employed to represent the system, the octopus of goods and data stretching around the world, apparently controlled by no one. Now experts fear artificial intelligence will take that control, and it may not be good for any of us. One of the best explanations of our quandary comes from California social philosopher Daniel Schmattenberger. We hear it in a powerful interview with Livbury, science presenter and an extraordinary mind in her own right. Thank you, Liv, for permission to rebroadcast. You need to know that AGI stands for Artificial General Intelligence, which is just AI for most of us. But what will it do in a system already heading towards extinction by climate and other means? Here is Daniel Schmattenberger with Livbury.
So what I'm actually really wanting to talk about is AI risk and a way of thinking about the totality of the AI risk landscape that is, for me, clarifying and a little different than the way AI risk is usually talked about, and maybe unifying across different categories of risk, and that give us some insight into how to think about what protecting against it might require. And the Moloch frame, I find, gives incredibly valuable insight in thinking about the AI risk frame, and the AGI misalignment issue is very helpful in thinking about the Moloch issue. I think the two metaphors clarify each other. And then I think the actual Moloch type dynamics give rise to the AI risk scenarios that I am most concerned about. And so that's what I'm wanting to talk about, which is why I was particularly interested in you and I having this conversation, since you're holding the mantle of helping the world understand the Moloch dynamics. So with that, I would love if you would share what the Moloch thing is about for people who don't already know. I know most of your listeners will already know, but why are we referring to it that way? What is the phenomena? Why is it interesting?
So probably the most concise definition I can give is that it's the god of negative sum games, like unhealthy competitive situations. So by that, I mean like a system of bad incentives that incentivize agents within that system, you know, players within that game, to sacrifice more and more of their other values in order to win the narrow, you know, win within that narrow domain. In other words, win the game. And by doing this sort of sacrifice of all these other values, they're essentially taking selfish actions that externalize harms to everybody else, both within that game and also, you know, even people outside of it, you know, to the wider system as a whole, and hence making the game a negative sum thing.
Right. So first, it's worth noting that each of these are already abstractions across a lot of cases, right? When we describe an arms race, whether it's these two countries or these two countries, and whether it's on hypersonic missiles or AI weapons or bioweapons, those are each different instances. So the generalization across the class of, if anyone is developing better weapons technologies, everybody else has to develop correspondingly the counters to those weapons and the same type of weapons, or they kind of lose by default, because it's a situation where anyone does something that increases their own security in a certain way that also inexorably decreases the security of others unless they do some counter response. So there's lots of different examples of an arms race, but arms races as a whole is already a big generalization. Tragedy of the commons is the same, right? Because we can be looking at a situation mm-hmm. where we're talking about overfishing or whaling or deforestation or desertification or CO2. And these are all cases where the overall commons is being degraded by every actor pursuing their own near-term incentives, right? The actual incentives laid out in the economic landscape. Right. But to recognize that when we look at every environmental issue facing the world, no one is trying to extinct all the species. Nobody is trying to desertify the planet. Nobody wants climate change or the Venusification of the planet. And yet the entire world is making it happen. When we look at features of the world that nobody wants and that are bad for everyone, why can't we change them? This is where the Moloch frame comes in, right?
Yeah.
And we can see that in both the arms race, everyone's like, look, I don't want to necessarily live in the world with the autonomous weapons or the bioweapons, but we have to because they're going to. And if we all make the agreement that we're not going to, how do we know they're keeping the agreement and they're not lying and defecting in some underground military base? So we have to assume under partial information that they are doing the thing, because the risk mm-hmm. test would be too high if we assume the other way. So under partial information, we have to assume that worst case, you know, do the same thing. They're assuming the same thing. So because of the inability for trust and coordination, we get this kind of race to the bottom. And the same is true in all these various scenarios. So we see a lot of features of the world that it seems like are comprehensively bad for everyone, trending in a much worse direction. Nobody can really do anything about and nobody wants. And so these properties are kind of the emergent properties of bad coordination. And so you have in other places described Moloch as the god of coordination failures, or basically the principle of coordination failures. The reason to talk about it as a, you know, a god or something is to say like, okay, well, since no agent is trying to make it this way, what is making it this way? Is there some kind of emergent agency or some underlying system dynamics? We can think of it as underlying system dynamics. And you and I and many people in our sphere both came across this frame from Scott Alexander's Meditations on Moloch paper that references both this great poem on Moloch and a number of pieces in popular culture. And if people haven't read it, everybody should read Scott Alexander's paper on Meditations on Moloch. Because what it's trying to get to is if every environmental issue from dead zone, all of these issues, nobody wants, but also nobody can stop because the cost of someone stopping it disadvantages them relative to everyone else. If everyone else is going to continue to externalize that cost to the commons rather than internalize it and decrease their profit margins. And so how do we deal with that thing? And if all of the things that are moving us towards increased likelihood for global catastrophic risk, or at least many of them have this in common, this is an underlying feature that we have to really understand, right? So you could call it the god of coordination failures of the unhealthy kind of game dynamics, not the ones that upregulate every, because yes, an arms race upregulates everyone's capacity in a certain way, but it is also upregulating a capacity that everyone wishes we didn't have that is only relevant because everybody else has it, right? If we could all just agree right. to decrease military spending by a factor of 10 and reinvest all of that in healthcare and infrastructure and everything, the world would be better by everyone's standards. So we're not saying that there are no types of competition that lead to positive some dynamics, but there are these other ones. So it's very interesting. Like Moloch can be seen as a kind of way of looking at generative dynamics that lead to the overall state of global catastrophic risk. Before we go all the way to Moloch, we could already say that collectives of lots of people interacting in particular ways, whether we say a public corporation or say a nation state, let's say we take a large public corporation, right? Well beyond what we have evolutionary history for. We had evolutionary history for tribal type size things below the Dunbar number where everybody could talk to everybody. So possibly the human scale ethics and whatever could perpetuate through the whole thing. At much larger scale, it changes, which is why the beginning of large civilizations started to have different properties. So you take a public corporation. Who's in control of it? Kind of nobody, right? Like the people in the corporation answer up to the executive team, answer to the CEO. The CEO answers to the board. The board answers to the shareholders. Right. The board has a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profit returns to shareholders. The shareholders are pension funds and whatever, where the managers of the shareholders are trying to get money back to the 401ks and the whoever is in there. There end up being pieces of law that are bound up through the whole thing, which is the liability limiting status of the corporation that can privatize gains and socialize losses, and the fiduciary responsibility of the directors to maximize shareholder profit, and the on and on. So who's really in charge of it? You can get rid of a CEO and put a new one in. You can get rid of a director, put a new one in. You can sell some of the shares, get a new shareholder. It's kind of this thing that gets set in motion where it has an objective function, which is now maximize profit within the domain of how it figured out how to do that thing. So, but because it is engaging, it's running on all these human intelligences, which are already general intelligence. So it can do things that the humans can do, plus things that none of those humans on their own could do, right? It takes a lot of humans together to do a Large Hadron Collider or a Hubble or an Exxon, right? It has a capacity that nobody could do on its own. So it is super intelligent. It is beyond human intelligence in that way, not just in a narrow way, because it's engaging people that are already generally intelligent. And then beyond just that, it's already engaging computation. So it's engaging the narrow but very powerful data processing. And now we add AI to that. And so we can say already that a nation state or a public corporation is kind of a cybernetic general intelligence that is already misaligned.
Can you just define what you mean by cybernetic?
Cybernetics, just the field of study for any type of system that kind of self-regulates, right? How the control mechanisms work, how the regulatory mechanisms work. So a corporation has feedback loops, it has feed-forward loops, it has regulatory processes to be able to maintain what it's doing and upgrade what it's doing, right? Nation state has that any. It is dealing with internal but also external pressures that force it to be what it is. Maybe Google didn't want to release its large language model yet, but as soon as its business model gets attacked by Microsoft releasing one and adding it to being in the possibility of search, then it has to. And so this is where the multipolar trap, the Molochian type dynamic comes in, is the individual organization is not totally sovereign because it's for it to keep existing, it has to deal with the pressures defined by others. And so either a sociopath can start something that then everybody has to deal with, or everyone, assuming the other one is about to do it next and no sociopath, has a situation that is functionally sociopathic. We talk about a corporate person, 14th Amendment, kind of giving personhood rights to a corporation in this weird way. So this, there's already a framework for thinking of it as an agent, right? The superintelligence as an agent. But the fiduciary responsibility to maximize profit makes it kind of an obligate sociopath. Right, that kind of thing has to take the opportunities it has, so long as it is not illegal within the confines of law, but it can work to change law, which is what why all big corporations lobby, right? And that ends up being one of the very profitable things that a company does, is rather than the regulator limiting it too much, it figuring out how to get the regulator to change regulation more aligned with its interests. So for it to say, hey, a shareholder profit maximization fiduciary responsibility in an oil company and solving climate change are incommensurable. A shareholder fiduciary profit maximization in military industrial contractors and a world of peace that would de-necessitate all the demand are incommensurable, right? Then those competing with each other, right? So then any of the AI groups are like, hey, I can't really do safety because the other ones, we all kind of have to race at this. And then maybe the whole US says, we don't want to regulate it because we would rather our guys get there before China gets there, because whoever has it's going to run the world and we'd at least like it to be US companies. And so that Molochian dynamic makes it to where each of these cybernetic superintelligences interacting with each other creates a meta cybernetic superintelligence that you can call Moloch, right? Which is why I wanted to talk with you about it, is you can see Moloch as an emergent property of the systems of incentives and the dynamics of coordination that are built into the system, where it is employing human general intelligence. It's employing computational capabilities and increasingly artificial intelligence and the whole rest of our tech stack. It is upregulating through competitive dynamics, but upregulating in this narrow benefit kind of way. And so we could say this thing that is driving climate change and driving species extinction and dead zones and oceans and coral loss and desertification and arms races and polarization and all like that, that is a misaligned superintelligence that nobody can pull the plug on. It's already autonomous. It's already nobody can pull the plug. And it is building AI. Because corporations...
See, it's not actually the people within. They think they're the ones building it.
Well, but they're building it within corporations that have a fiduciary responsibility for profit maximization, right, that are in multipolar traps with other companies that are racing to do it, that mm-hmm. have to look at how do we commercialize this thing, whatever it is, right? Or they're building it within nation states that have to be able to compete with another nation state. And what that means is that some narrow value metrics that define what wins the competition get prioritized over wide value metrics. And so it is fair to say that we already have a misaligned autopoetic superintelligence running the world, running all of the people to various degrees. It is already employing all of the computational power. It is developing more computational power in AI. The AI is being built by it in service of itself. So the AI risk scenario that Yudkowsky or Bostrom or others put forward of a thing where you can't pull the plug, it is upgrading its capacity to do what it does. It has an objective function it's pursuing, but it harms stuff that we wouldn't want harmed in its objective function in the pursuit of it. What I'm arguing is that we are already there, and it is our world system, and that AI is simply accelerating it, and that we don't have to get to AGI to have the effect of it, because you already have GI. We already have general intelligence in the form of the corporations, nation states, and the overall system, where then adding AI, even if it is not fully generalized to that system, you already have something that is autonomous in general, that is now getting increasingly potent capacities, even if it's within a bunch of narrow domains, right? So before we get to the case of just autonomous AI being its own risk, the existing AI in this landscape is driving the entire risk landscape, is driving the overall, is accelerating the topology that is already in place. And this is why I said I think the misaligned AGI as a thought experiment helps people understand Moloch. But what the reality of Moloch helps people understand that without getting to a total AGI, that the nature of the risk there is already happening. Then with that, we have to say, what would it take to prevent those risks? And it's a different calculus. It's a different way of thinking about it.
You are listening to science communicator Liv Bury with California big picture thinker Daniel Schmattenberger. This is Radio EcoShock. The topic is kind of why we build a hell that no one wants, and how AI will help us do it faster.
So what do we do?
Let me make it a little bit more tangible first and talk about what do the actual risks of AI look like. I'll give a few different categorizations. And I want to say I am not an AI alignment expert or a AI risk expert. There are a lot of experts at places like MIRI and Redwood and other places that I think people should listen to, pay a lot of attention to. I'm familiar enough with those arguments, and then very specifically with the metacrisis argument, to see how it relates, and that's what I'm speaking to here. There's something very unique about AI relative to all other forms of technology. I'll speak to the deeper part in a moment, but to begin with, synthetic biology is very powerful. Like, obviously, it's very, very powerful. There are awesome applications. There are awful applications. But synthetic bio does not automatically give us the ability to make better drones. It doesn't give us the ability to make better high-speed trading. It doesn't give us the ability to make better nukes. Mm-hmm. Nukes don't automatically give us better bioweapons. AI gives us better all of them. That's an important thing, is that AI has the capacity to do optimization across all the things, which means the good things, which is what we all want. We want to have AI work on protein folding for immuno-oncology to cure cancer, and on receptor sites for new drug discovery and to make supply chains more efficient and things like that. But everything that AI can optimize, it can also break. You run it in reverse, right? The AI that was doing drug discovery, I think it was Oak Ridge National Laboratories, ran in reverse and came up with a bunch of chemical weapons very rapidly. And
minus sign in front of it, essentially.
And an AI that can optimize supply chains can also optimize exactly how to break them, right? Can optimize terrorist attacks on them, even just through cyber and things like that. Right. AI that can do protein folding for immuno-oncology can also make bioweapons. And so the first principle is that it's very hard to advance AI, right? It takes massive GPU farms. It takes only a few companies in the world that can even do the chip manufacturing to do that kind of thing. It takes a lot of computer science talent, massive amounts of data, et cetera. But once it's developed and then it is connected to the internet, like a large language model can run on a lot less compute than it's trained on. It takes a lot to train. It doesn't take that much to run it.
Right.
That's a big deal. And it takes a lot to figure it out. Once it's been figured out and you publish the paper, and this is one of the key things is –
it's like building software. You know, it's very hard to build. You know, you need programming knowledge and so on to build a software. But once you've built it and you've built the sort of user interface, any old schmuck can use it and get and like reap the benefits from it.
So if you have a company like a Google or an OpenAI or whatever that says, hey, we're going to put safety parameters on this, I think there's a bunch of arguments against why that is. Even if they could do it, won't be adequate. But they can't because, you know, you had the, I think it was Llama or Alpaca, the Stanford Meta one that ended up getting leaked through some GitHub leak, and then somebody
downloaded
it onto a computer, 4chan. Started sharing it. And that means the full power of something that probably cost tens of millions of dollars to train is now unlocked and will be available for anybody to use for all the purposes. So the safety's not there. There are some projects working on decentralized AI that are about to make at least GPT 3.5 level kind of unlocked, widely available. That thing is impossible to avoid. The thing to understand is that it takes a lot of work to develop the new capacity. Once it's developed, the barrier of entry to be able to do the things that it allows to be done has been radically lowered for everybody. That all the good things come from that. We can all do more creative stuff. That's exciting. All the bad things come from that. And so there's this principle that we could say all technology is dual use, right? You're developing it for some positive purpose, but it has a military application. But it's not just dual. Every technology is kind of omni-use, meaning it will get used for all the uses that people have incentives to use it for who are capable of using it. So however much you lower the barrier of entry, anyone who can go into that barrier of entry now will use it for the things they have incentives for. So you develop it for we're going to cure cancer, but now you've got that ability for biological engineering really easily available widely, right? A couple things. The first thing to understand about AI is AI can make better cyber weapons, better nuclear weapons, better drone weapons, better all of those things, better info weapons, better population-centric weapons. And so it increases the capacity to increase all the other risks in a way no other thing does. You could kind of say, well, oil does that, right? Energy, every industry needs energy. Well, yeah, but it's not doing the novelty search part of figuring out new, better ways to make those domains. It's simply just allowing them to do more of it, right? The AI both allows you to scale the stuff, but also allows the innovation of way new, better stuff. And obviously, we can think about the ones that just involve synthetic media and increasing hypernormal stimuli and ubiquitous deep fakes and really dreadful things like that, right? Like there's, in terms of population-centric warfare and breakdown of government and public trust, and there's a lot that are very, very near term. So this is one set of risks. Anything that the AI can optimize, it can also break. That's kind of the bad actor case. But the other case, the more Molochian case, is just accelerating the thing that is already happening. The externalities that aren't included in the optimization function is accelerating the externalities when we're already hitting the tipping points on the externalities. Mm. So you could say, yeah, but AI is going to make it to where we can produce things so much more efficiently that it'll actually save the environment. One risk of AI is that anything you can use to optimize, you can also use it to break. It increases all of the other risks in a way nothing else increases all of the other risks. It increases the total complexity of the risk landscape, et cetera. The other one is that even when you're using it for the positive purposes and you're succeeding at whatever your positive purposes are, you're also speeding up externality right as we're hitting the tipping points. The next problem is you're increasing the info complexity. I think Yudkowsky calls it inscrutable matrices of floating point numbers, talking about the large language models, and like nobody actually knows what's going on inside of them, right? Yeah. They're these kind of black boxes. So the only thing that could figure out, is your AI actually doing the thing it's supposed to do or not? How do you, if we wanted a law in some way to be able to regulate it or adjudicate what's happening, it would take another AI that's more powerful to do it. So now you end up getting an increase of the race towards the info singularity, where people can't actually make sense of or adjudicate any of what's happening, right? The total complexity of everything is beyond our ability to process. And that just means the unsolvability of everything increases. What I'm saying is that if you add something as fastly recursive and powerful as the increasingly generalized AIs that we have to an already misaligned superintelligence near the boundary points of breakdown, that's a problem. And that we should figure out alignment first. So what I'm suggesting is, in the way that the AI risk community is saying we should really try to figure out alignment before we race forward on developing more powerful AIs, I'm saying, yes, we really need to figure out alignment, but it doesn't just mean alignment of the AIs. It means alignment of the existing general intelligences, the cybernetic general intelligence.
The capitalist model, essentially.
So it's not fair to call it capitalism. It's more like game theory. Capitalism just makes it easy to think about because there is actually a metric. And it turns out that capital can be used for population-centric warfare or supply chain or most any of those things. It ends up being kind of a unit of power pretty widely. But yes, that system, and it's hard to even call it a system, right? That set of perverse incentives and the coordinations that arise from it is misaligned, reaching criticality. Alignment in that thing has to be figured out, because a misaligned context cannot develop aligned AI.
It can't emerge from it. Because that's, I think, some people's hope, is that just give it enough capability and some emergent magic will essentially come.
This is, I think, why the orthogonality thesis is important, which is to say it is possible to get very good at optimizing and not get good at picking good goals, right? Those are two separate things. And we already see that in the world. We're already much more good at creating tech than we are at creating a world that everybody thinks is a world that really makes sense, right? So exponential tech gives us the power of gods. We have not yet seemed to demonstrate the love and wisdom of gods needed to bind it. We have to figure that thing out, or this thing kind of caps out. Same with the AI. Well,
right, and we've handed it over to the shitty god, the worst one.
So AI has fast enough feedback loops and enough power that it is one of the only things that could help change the other thing in time, change the paperclip maximizing nature of the global system, right, of the Moloch system in time, but only if it was developed in association with the cybernetic systems that were actually aligned. And aligned here doesn't just mean with our intent. Aligned means actually with our long-term well-being. And this is one of the critical issues, is when we talk about alignment, aligning AIs with human intent would not be great, because human intent is not awesome so far, right? Like, that's kind of the point, is that whether we are looking at the overfishing of the oceans or proxy wars or whatever it is, we're like, do we want to give exponentially more power to this species with its intent caught in multipolar traps the way that it is? It is not a good steward of power. In the Bronze Age, it wasn't. In the Iron Age, it wasn't. It still isn't. But with exponentially more power, exponential externalities and exponential conflict both eventually break the finite playing field. And solving those coordination failure, multipolar trap type dynamics are necessary for the wisdom to be able to prevail adequately. I am very hopeful of the uniquely positive things to support coordination that computational capabilities and artificial intelligence in particular can help with. They are not being developed for those purposes and in contexts that have the right frameworks and the right incentives currently. It's very much the opposite thing. So rather than build them to be able to change Moloch, they are being built by Moloch in its service. Even though no one building them would say that, but the nature of the capital that they are building it with has that built right into it.
Inherently, yeah.
This condensed version of Liv Bury with Daniel Schmattenberger was posted on Vimeo. It comes from a one-hour-plus YouTube version posted on March 30th, 2023. Find links to watch in my show blog at ecoshock.org. My thanks to Liv Bury at livbury.com for permission to broadcast, and to Daniel for trying the hardest question there is.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Will wildfires push faster climate change? Are wildland fires increasing? Is the vast boreal forest around the world in trouble? Frightening fire news has been pouring in, most recently from northern Alberta and nearby Canadian provinces. Nobody knows wildfire science better than Dr. Michael Flanagan. He is the longtime professor at the University of Alberta, now at Thompson Rivers University. Mike held leading roles as BC Innovation Research Chair in Emergency Management and Fire Science. Flanagan was editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildland Fire. He is an internationally known wildfire expert. From Kamloops, British Columbia, Mike Flanagan, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
It seems strange to find you anywhere but Alberta. What are you up to?
I am doing exactly what I've been doing for the last 40 years, is studying fire, weather, climate change. And you know, originally it was with the Canadian Forest Service, and then the University of Alberta, and now Thompson Rivers University. And you know, to be honest, BC and BC Interior particularly have been the hotbed of fire activity the last few years, 2017, 2018, 2021, all very active years in BC. So I'm here trying to address some of the issues related to wildland fire.
Well, I know about those fires. I've lived through a couple of them, and we've been nervous ever since. So, very early spring fires in northern Alberta forced the evacuation of almost 30,000 people this year. Two big fires approached the town of Fox Creek, population over 2,000 people. Mike, how would you describe these spring fires for our international listeners?
So, for Alberta, May is the busiest month for fire activity. So this isn't unusual. And if you go back in time, 2011, part of a town of Slave Lake burned down. 2016, of course, Fort McMurray had the fire. 2019, high level, Chuckate Creek fire. So every 3 to 5 years, we seem to see this activity. And spring activity is kind of common all across Canada. It's that period. Most of Canada has snow for a good chunk of the winter. Once the snow leaves, it exposes that dead organic material from the previous autumn. And it's this dead organic material is easy for a fire to start and spread in. And so you see a bump across Canada of human-caused fires typically. But in Alberta, it's so pronounced because of the weather and because there's so much human activity on the landscape, industrial, oil, gas, forestry, but also recreational activities that start fires. So you get the weather, you get the ignitions, and if the fuel's dry, you're ready for fire.
Well, I'm just a little confused because these big fires actually started in very late April. I thought there might be still snow on the ground up there. Sometimes there are in the far north. What happened this spring to help fire conditions?
So whether you're in Alberta or the Amazon or Australia, there are three ingredients required for a fire to occur, and it applies everywhere. First is vegetation. We call it fuel because it's the stuff that burns, whether it's the grass and needles on the forest floor, the shrubs, the trees, how much you have, what type, how dry it is, important aspects. Second, you need ignition. In Canada and in Alberta, it's about 50-50 in terms of human-caused or lightning-caused. So there's a seasonal shift with human-caused dominating in the spring and lightning-caused dominating in the summer. And third, conducive fire weather. We say hot, dry, windy. You can get by with dry and windy, but this year, you know, central and northern Alberta had all three in spades. It was a very dry or droughty winter, so the stage was set, and over a million hectares has burned. And in terms of year to date, that's the most active fire month in our records. 1981 had more fire over the entire season, but there was a very hot, dry August that dominated that fire season. So it is historic in that sense. This is the most area burned we've seen so early in the season. In terms of evacuations, yes, a lot of different communities impacted, and so it was very challenging. Of course, 2016 evacuation numbers were close to 90,000 because of the community of Fort McMurray. A very active, very early season, primarily human-caused fires. There was some early lightning this year, which started some of the fires, but human-caused fires that are mostly accidental. Arson is not a large problem in Canada, but, you know, wherever humans go, fire follows.
You know, as we speak, an extreme rainfall event is pounding down on our roof and our yard. And I was wondering, didn't the repeated atmospheric rivers that struck the West Coast this past winter, I guess they just didn't reach northern Alberta and the Peace River region. Wasn't the snowpack big there too?
No, it was abnormally dry for much of Alberta. Mountains are a very good blocker for precipitation. They squeeze a lot of precipitation out in the form of snow or rain, depending on your elevation. So, yeah, the pattern was not quite the same for Alberta. And actually, parts of BC, especially the Peace Country, the northeast corner, were also dry, as well as parts of the interior. So that the coastal range sucked a lot of that moisture out of the atmosphere. Snowpacks were normal, some places a little bit above, some places a little bit below, but Alberta was dry. I will add one caveat. We have been in La Nina, a triple dip La Nina, which is now over, and we're ENSO neutral, but all the models suggest we're going to El Nino, and we may be going to a moderate to strong El Nino fairly quickly. And that means warmer and drier conditions for parts of Western Canada, in particular BC. So BC could have a very active fire season, but I can't say if it's going to be a record-breaking year. I mean, we're getting close to our 10-year running average, and it's, you know, still May. So looks like an active year. Record-breaking, hard to say.
So fire's a natural part of the forest ecosystem. Maybe the real problem is that more humans are moving into fire zones and then demanding expensive firefighting. What do you think?
The way we've dealt with fire is at least Western European approach when they came here through colonization was that fire was bad and that we should put fire out at all costs. And that's just not the right approach anymore. And even the iconic Smokey the Bear has a couple messages. One is, you know, only you can prevent forest fires, which is a great message. But the other one is kind of fire is bad and we should bring it out. Fire is natural. It's Mother Nature at work. It's the cycle of life. Our boreal forest in particular survives and thrives in a regime of semi-regular stand-renewing, stand-replacing, high-intensity fire. And the trees have lots of strategies to deal with this. Some of the pines and some spruce have what we call serotonous cones. These are cones that have a waxy resin, and they need heat to open up the cones to release the seed. Fire provides that heat. So you see a stand of jack pine, a fire goes through, you get another stand of jack pine. It's just Mother Nature at work, and for years we've been fighting Mother Nature, but now we are moving forward, and when and where possible, we try and work with Mother Nature and allow fire back on the landscape. And soon enough, you get a patchwork of recently burned areas, and this becomes important because recently burned areas are unlikely to reburn for 10, 20 years, if it's a wetland, even 50 years. Or if they do catch fire, they're low-intensity fire, and if they're unwanted, we can put them out. And, you know, there's lots of reasons to put fire in the landscape. Think of mountain pine beetle outbreak we had in British Columbia, you know, a decade and a half ago. Fire is a great agent knocking down mountain pine beetle. Spruce budworm out east, and there's lots of forest pests that fire kind of keeps a lid on. So fire is actually natural, in some cases good. Of course, if it's 2 kilometers from your doorstep, that's not good, and we have to put those fires out.
Okay. Now, my concern, though, is about wildfires changing with climate change. And you've co-authored a few papers on that, even in the last couple of years. How have fires changed as the world warms?
So as we warm, we are seeing more fire. And, you know, people say, hold on, why is temperature so important? And here I'm not talking about an individual fire like the Lytton Fire or the Fort McMurray Fire, where wind becomes very critical. I'm talking about fire over a larger area, like the province of Ontario, for a longer period of time, like decades. And temperature is really important for three reasons. First, the warmer it is, the longer the fire season. And we're seeing that in parts of Canada already. Alberta, for example, official fire season start is now March 1st. Last decade, it was April 1st. Fire seasons are starting earlier and lasting longer. Last fall, 2022, we had high-intensity crown fires burning in the Northwest Territories through the night in October, and I've never seen that before. Right now, there's active fires in the Northwest Territories into May, and that's, you know, not unheard of, but it's uncommon. Second, the warmer it gets, the more lightning we see. And, you know, I did mention that in Canada, it's about 50-50 between human cause and lightning cause, but those lightning cause fires are causing 80 to 90% of the area burned. And human cause fires, the numbers have been going down and the area burn has been going down due to education and fire bans. So increased lightning means more fire, okay? And, you know, that's if things are being equal, but actually things aren't equal because the third reason is probably the most important, is as the temperature increases, the ability of the atmosphere to suck the moisture out of the fuel increases almost exponentially. So what that means is we'll get drier fuels unless we see increases in precipitation to compensate for this drying effect from warming. But all the forecasts or models of futures suggest most areas of Canada, our fire seasons are going to be drier, not wetter. So the bottom line here is if we're warmer, we're going to see drier fuels. And this is a critical aspect about fire. The drier the fuel, the easier it is for fires to start, easier it is for fires to spread, and it means more fuel, vegetation, is available to burn, which leads to those higher intensity fires, which are difficult to impossible to extinguish.
The Copernicus satellite monitoring system found very high carbon emissions from these recent fires in the Canadian West, the highest carbon emissions since 2019, they said. Are wildfires pumping a lot of new carbon into the atmosphere?
And this is where we have to really dig down a bit here. So on upland sites, many of these sites are what I would call carbon neutral over a longer time period. Yes, when a fire goes through, it ejects large amounts of carbon into the atmosphere through the combustion process. But then those new pine trees or aspen trees start sucking up the carbon and start to grow, and so it balances out. Where the balance sheet doesn't balance is on those wetlands, peatlands in particular. You know, peat is organic material that's 40 centimeters or more in depth. Typically sphagnum mosses are example. So they've been building up carbon, organic biomass, for thousands of years since the last ice age. So it's a carbon bank, a storage. So when a fire goes through, you can burn thousands of years of accumulation into the atmosphere. So, yes, there's the potential for significant releases from these peatlands. And I'll put into context, there was work done in Indonesia on peat fires there during a particularly bad year in the late 90s. And they found that the carbon emissions were equivalent to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions. The peatlands and the boreal forests are 30 times more than what Indonesia has. So there's an enormous amount of potential greenhouse gas release from these fires. So the argument is the warmer we get, which we just talked about, the more fires we see. The more fires we see in the boreal wetlands, peatlands, means significant increases in greenhouse gases, which feeds the warming, which makes it warmer, which means more fire, eventually the cycle breaks down because you burn all the peat. That's it. You use up your whole bank account. But there's other aspects too, because, you know, as you go farther north, there's something called permafrost. And this is just a layer of ice that stays all year long below the surface. And in this organic material, there's hydrates. And this goes for the seabed floors as well. If it thaws, it releases these hydrates, primarily methane. Methane is a very effective greenhouse gas. So this could also feed the warming. So, yes, it is a real concern.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Alex is talking wildfires with Canadian expert Dr. Michael Flanagan.
Well, another factor I think about is timing. I mean, even if those big dumps of carbon dioxide are recaptured by new trees in a few years, I worry in the meantime the extra carbon could add enough warming to trigger other changes in the climate system. Would you agree the time factor for wildfire emissions might be critical?
So there's a lot of moving parts here. Okay. So some aspects of fire are contributing to warming and some aspects are not. Okay. So what does contribute is injection of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Absolutely. You know, generates more warming. Black carbon being deposited on snow and ice definitely is a warming factor and helps, you know, the melting of ice and snow more rapidly because black surfaces absorb the solar radiation instead of the white surfaces reflecting it. But when fire goes through and takes out a conifer forest, which are dominant in many of our northern areas in the boreal, during the winter, instead of having a green land cover, you now have a white land cover, and so you have an albedo effect that's a cooling effect. So the solar radiation comes in, gets bounced back into space, whereas if there had been a forest there, the green conifer forest would be absorbing that solar radiation. So there's checks and balances in our system. So it's hard to say, you know, exactly how significant this is. And this is a Nature Science paper waiting to be done to take a look at, you know, the accounting sheet and the checks and balances to see how big and which direction. I argue it is a warming influence overall, but I have colleagues who say it's a net cooling effect. Who's right? Well, let's do the work and find out.
Wow. That's a big question. So in our 2011 interview, you gave two reasons why burned forests might not return at all. First, a super hot fire may sterilize the soil, and second, if the fire returns within just a few seasons, the conifer starts may not have reached that seeding age. Do either of these apply in this year's Alberta fires?
Potentially. You know, as we see more and more fire in the landscape, trees may not reach sexual maturity so that you get no regeneration. So these repeat disturbances, fire after fire, in close succession, are a real problem for regeneration. And there are papers out there that suggest in places like Alberta that the boreal forest, as we know it, in terms of the trees, may disappear as early as, you know, sometime mid to later this century, which is a scary thought. So if you look back in the past, there were times where Alberta was not forested. But it doesn't mean fire is going to disappear, because what replaces the forest will be either a shrubland or a grassland. And grasslands can burn every year. As long as we have those three ingredients, vegetation / fuel, ignition, and weather, we're going to have fire. But yeah, that is a concern that, you know, if we keep seeing fire after fire after fire, especially these high-intensity fires like we've been seeing, trees will have trouble regenerating. Of course, humans can play a role because we plant a great deal of the boreal forest that's been harvested. We plant. So we could do this with burned areas as well to keep it forested, at least in the short term.
That's a pretty big-scale project. It would be expensive, but I could see it being possible. So last week, I spoke with Dr. Andrew Dessler, the atmospheric scientist at Texas A&M University. Andrew said warming was pushing more extremes in the hydrological cycle, so we may get extreme rainfall events followed by a longer than normal dry spell. And I thought about you, and I thought, well, maybe with these thin northern soils that can dry in just a few hot days, maybe this new pattern of extreme rains and then drought could spur like periods of wildfires during the summer as opposed to just one long summer of fire.
Extremes are another critical aspect of understanding fire. In Canada, 2 to 3% of our fires burn, 97% of the area burned. Western United States, it's even more dramatic. 1% of the fires burn, 99% of the area burned. And much of this happens on a relatively small number of extreme fire weather days. So extremes drive the business. The tail wags the dog. You know, a fire that starts on average summer day, if it's one of those unwanted fires a couple kilometers from Grand Prairie or wherever, it's easy to put out. But if the fire starts on one of those critical extreme fire weather days and the fuels are dry, you have a very narrow window to put that fire out. It's easy to put out when it's small, but once it gets bigger than a soccer pitch or football field, it becomes very challenging, perhaps even impossible. And this can happen in minutes. Litton fire, from the time it started until the time it was burning down the town, was between 15 and 20 minutes. So you have a very narrow window to respond to a fire in those situations. And as we go forward with climate change, we expect more extremes at both ends of the spectrum, drought and flood. But on the drought side, that's where our fires often occur. And we are seeing more extreme fire weather in the last 40 years, and we expect this trend to continue. So we expect to see, in many parts of the world, more fire activity. So we have to learn to live with fire. And unfortunately, the smoke. There are kind of three aspects of fires that are challenging. First, there's the flames, okay, that can burn down your community. Second, there's smoke that can travel thousands of kilometers. So if you're downtown Toronto, the likelihood of your place burning down from a wildland fire is essentially zero. Your air quality could be in the tank for weeks because of fires in northern Ontario, northern Quebec. Smoke can travel thousands of kilometers, and the more we know about smoke, we know it's really bad for humans, okay? And the third reason is what I'll call cascading effects. And those atmospheric rivers of 2021 in British Columbia are a classic example. You had fires all along the Coquihalla Highway, interior BC, a major corridor for getting to the coast. And then the rains come in November, atmospheric rivers, and you get flooding, debris flows. You know, the fires don't cause that, but those areas are much more likely to flood and cause debris flows. Some of the ash can be what we call hydrophobic. It means it repels water, so it's almost like the rain's coming down on concrete. And if you have some topography, it just flows straight downhill and causes all sorts of problems.
Can fire smoke reach the stratosphere where it would stay much longer in the atmosphere and travel around the world?
It does. Okay, something called pyro-CBs, pyrocumulonimbus, fire-generated thunderstorms, and work published from Australia had a horrific fire season in 2019/2020, and the amount of smoke injected into the stratosphere was like a moderate volcano in equivalence. It caused regional cooling and all sorts of other climatic influences. So, yes, and once the stratosphere is a very stable layer and material can get in there and stay there for many years and also can inject moisture into the stratosphere. Moisture is a byproduct of the combustion process, and these fire-generated thunderstorms go from smoke to actually pyrocumulus clouds with water vapor, and water vapor also can play a role in the climate system. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways that fires influence our climate system.
Mike, you've been advising governments at all levels about wildfires. Have you formulated ideas for forest management policies? What should society be doing when it comes to wildfires?
There's lots that we can do, okay? And there's lots that we are doing, but, that we can do some things better, okay? First, all human-caused fires are preventable. So we can do a better job with fire bans and use a tool called forest closures even more, which are even more effective. Not very popular, and Alberta actually did use them eventually this fire season. California's used them, Ontario's used them. All it means is you close the forest to industrial activity and recreational activity. No people, no people-caused fires. So there's one clear example. And now I'll pull on some emergency management perspectives. Emergency management has phases: prevention, mitigation, preparedness, response, recovery. Some people include review. So fire management does a really great job at preparedness and even a better job at response. We can do better in prevention, okay? And, you know, using those fire bans and forest closures, continuing education is useful. As I say, in Canada, human-caused fires are going down, which is great, okay? But, you know, we should be able to eliminate them. And whether they're coming from power lines, railways, campfires, agricultural burning, et cetera, we need to do better. We can have enhanced early warning system. We have early warning systems now, but I think they can be improved through tools like machine learning, artificial intelligence. But the way we respond is still at times what I'll call a knee-jerk reaction, in that we ask for additional resources, whether it's crews or helicopters, after the fire episode or event has already started. As I mentioned, our weather forecasts are good for about, you know, 7 days or so. We can see like a freight train that was coming, you know, this May to Alberta and saying, hey, we should be prepared. We should call for additional resources, crews, right now. And there's a facility in Winnipeg called CIFC, Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, that arranges this. But by the time you make the call, it takes 3 days for that helicopter or that crew to reach the fire line. If you make the call when the fire is already burning, that's too late, okay? You need to make the call before the fire starts. And using things to say, where are we expecting the extreme fire weather to occur? Up to a week in advance. Where do we expect new fires to start? Up to a week in advance, so we can get the resources we need and move them to the appropriate locations to deal with those unwanted fires, I mean, is where we should be going.
And as we wrap up, have you seen one of these fire monsters up close yourself?
Yes. Quite a few, yes. Elephant Hill in 2017, it was just burning like stink. And it was actually on a CBC Nature of Things show. Into the Fire, if I recall what it was called. And you know, there's some great video of that fire. They're frightening to be close to. They're like a freight train and a lot of heat, and they generate their own wind. Yeah, it's quite something to be close to a large, high-intensity fire.
From Thompson River University in BC, we've been speaking with longtime fire expert Dr. Michael Flanagan. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mike, thank you for taking the time to help us understand. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.